This is Rachel, recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with Part 3 of Dracula by Bram Stoker. Where his body has gone, why may not another body go? I have seen him myself crawl from his window. Why should I not imitate him and go in by his window? The chances are desperate, but my need is more desperate still. I shall risk it. At the worst, it can only be death, and a man's death is not a calf's, and the dreaded hereafter may still be open to me. God help me in my task. Goodbye, Mina, if I fail. Goodbye, my faithful friend and second father. Goodbye, all, and last of all, Mina. The same day, later. I have made the effort, and, God helping me, have come safely back to this room. I must put down every detail in order. I went, whilst my courage was fresh, straight to the window on the south side, and at once got outside on the narrow ledge of stone which runs round the building on this side. The stones were big, and roughly cut, and the mortars had by process of time been washed away between them. I took off my boots and ventured out in the desperate way. I looked down once, so as to make sure that a sudden glimpse of the awful depth would not overcome me, but after that kept my eyes away from it. I knew pretty well the direction and distance of the Count's window, and made for it as well as I could, having regard to the opportunities available. I did not feel dizzy. I suppose I was too excited, and at the time, ridiculously short, till I found myself standing on the windowsill and trying to raise up the sash. I was filled with agitation, however, when I bent down and slid feet foremost in through the window. Then I looked around for the Count, but, with surprise and gladness, made a discovery. The room was empty. It was barely furnished with odd things, which seemed to have never been used. The furniture was something the same style as that in the south rooms, and was covered with dust. I looked for the key, but it was not in the lock, and I could not find it anywhere. The only thing I found was a great heap of gold in one corner. Gold of all kinds, Roman and British and Austrian and Hungarian and Greek and Turkish money, covered with a film of dust, though as though it had lain long in the ground. None of it that I noticed was less than 300 years old. There were also chains and ornaments, some jeweled, but all of them old and stained. At one corner of the room was a heavy door. I tried it, for since I could not find the key of the room or the key of the outer door, which was the main object of my search, I must make further examination or all my efforts would be in vain. It was open, and led through a stone passage to a circular stairway which went steeply down. I descended, minding carefully where I went, for the stairs were dark, being only lit by loopholes in the heavy masonry. At the bottom there was a dark, tunnel-like passage, through which came a deathly, sickly odor, the odor of old earth newly turned. As I went through the passage, the smell grew closer and heavier. At last I pulled open a heavy door which stood ajar, and found myself in an old ruined chapel, which had evidently been used as a graveyard. The roof was broken, and in two places were steps leading to vaults, but the ground had been recently dug over, and the earth placed in great wooden boxes, manifestly those which had been brought by the Slovaks. There was nobody about, and I made search of any further outlet, but there was none. And then I went over every inch of the ground, so as not to lose a chance. I went down even into the vaults, where the dim light struggled, although to do so was a dread to my very soul. Into two of these I went, but saw nothing except fragments of old coffins and piles of dust. In the third, however, I made a discovery. There, in one of the great boxes, in which there were 50 in all, on a pile of newly dug earth, lay the Count. He was either dead or asleep, I could not say which, for the eyes were open and stony, but without the glassiness of death, and the cheeks had the warmth of life through all their pallor, and the lips were as red as ever. But there was no sign of movement, no pulse, no breath, no beating of the heart. I bent over him and tried to find any sign of life, but in vain. He could not have lain there long, for the earthy smell would have passed away in a few hours. By the side of the box was its cover, pierced with holes here and there. I thought he might have the keys on him, but when I went to search, I saw the dead eyes, and in them, dead though they were, such a look of hate, though unconscious of me or my presence, that I fled from the place, and leaving the Count's room by the window, crawled again up the castle wall. Regaining my own chamber, I threw myself panting upon the bed and tried to think. 29th of June. Today is the date of my last letter, and the Count has taken steps to prove that it was genuine, for again I saw him leave the castle by the same window and in my clothes. As he went down the wall, lizard fashion, I wish I had a gun or some lethal weapon that I might destroy him, but I fear that no weapon wrought alone by man's hand would have any effect on him. I dared not wait to see him return, for I feared to see those weird sisters. I came back to the library and read there until I fell asleep. I was awakened by the Count, who looked at me as grimly as a man can look and said, "Tomorrow, my friend, we must part. You return to your beautiful England, I to some work which may have an end that we may never meet. Your letter home has been dispatched. Tomorrow I shall not be here, but all shall be ready for your journey. In the morning come the Cisgani, who have some labors of their own here, and come some Slovaks. When they have gone, my carriage shall come for you, and shall bear you to the Borgo Pass to meet the diligence from Bukovina to Bistritz. I am in hopes that I shall see more of you at Castle Dracula." I suspected him, and determined to test his sincerity. Sincerity! It seems like a profanation of the word to write it in connection with such a monster. So I asked him point blank, "Why may I not go tonight?" "Because, dear sir, my coachman and horses are away on a mission." "But I would walk with pleasure. I want to get away at once." He smiled, with such a soft, smooth, diabolical smile, I knew there was some trick behind his smoothness. He said, "And your baggage?" "I do not care about it. I can send for it some other time." The Count stood up, and said, with a sweet courtesy which made me rub my eyes, it seemed so real, "You English have a saying which is close to my heart, for its spirit is that which rules our boyars. Welcome the coming, speed the parting guest. Come with me, my dear friend. Not an hour shall you wait in my house against your will, though sad am I at your going, and that you so suddenly desire it. Come." With a stately gravity, he, with the lamp, preceded me down the stairs and along the hall. Suddenly he stopped. Hark! Close at hand came the howling of many wolves. It was almost as if the sound sprang up at the raising of his hand, just as the music of a great orchestra seems to leap under the baton of a conductor. After a pause of a moment, he proceeded, in his stately way, to the door, drew back the ponderous bolts, unhooked the heavy chains, and began to draw it open. To my immense astonishment, I saw it was unlocked. Suspiciously, I looked all around, but could see no key of any kind. As the door began to open, the howling of the wolves without grew louder and angrier. Their red jaws, with champing teeth, and their blunt-clawed feet as they leaped, came in through the opening door. I knew then that to struggle at the moment against the Count was useless. With such allies as these at his command, I could do nothing. But still, the door continued slowly to open, and only the Count's body stood in the gap. Suddenly it struck me that this might be the moment and the means of my doom. I was to be given to the wolves, and at my own instigation. There was a diabolical wickedness in the idea great enough for the Count, and as a last chance I cried out, "Shut the door, I shall wait until morning," and covered my face with my hands to hide my tears of bitter disappointment. With one sweep of his powerful arm, the Count threw the door shut, and the great bolts clanged and echoed through the hall as they shot back into their places. In silence we returned to the library, and after a minute or two I went to my own room. The last I saw of Count Dracula was his kissing his hand to me, with a red light of triumph in his eyes, and a smile that Judas in hell might be proud of. When I was in my room, and about to lie down, I thought I heard a whispering at my door. I went to it softly and listened. Unless my ears deceived me, I heard the voice of the Count. Back, back to your own place. Your time is not yet come. Wait, have patience. Tomorrow night is yours. There was a low, sweet ripple of laughter, and in a rage I threw open the door and saw without the three terrible women licking their lips. As I appeared, they all joined in a horrible laugh and ran away. I came back to my room and threw myself on my knees. Is it so near the end? Tomorrow, tomorrow, Lord help me and those to whom I am dear. June 30th, the morning. These may be the last words I ever write in this diary. I slept till just before the dawn, and when I woke, threw myself on my knees, for I determined if death came, he should find me ready. At last, I felt that subtle change in the air, and I knew that the morning had come. Then came the welcome cock crow, and I felt that I was safe. With a glad heart, I opened my door and ran down the hall. I had seen that the door was unlocked, and now escape was before me. With hands that trembled with eagerness, I unhooked the chains and drew back the massive bolts. But the door would not move. Despair seized me. I pulled and pulled at the door and shook it till, massive as it was, it rattled in its casement. I could see the bolt shock. It had been locked after I left the Count. Then a wild desire took me to obtain that key at any risk, and I determined then and there to scale the wall again and gain the Count's room. He might kill me, but death now seemed the happier choice of evils. Without a pause, I rushed up to the east window and scrambled down the wall as before into the Count's room. It was empty, but that was as I expected. I could not see a key anywhere, but the heap of gold remained. I went through the door in the corner and down the winding stair and along the dark passage to the old chapel. I knew now well enough where to find the monster I sought. The great box was in the same place, close against the wall, but the lid was laid on it, not fastened down, but with the nails ready in their places to be hammered home. I knew I must search the body for the key, so I raised the lid and laid it back against the wall, and I saw something which filled my very soul with horror. There lay the Count, but looking as if his youth had been half renewed, for the white hair and mustache were changed to a dark iron gray. The cheeks were fuller, the white skin seemed ruby red underneath, the mouth was redder than ever, for on the lips were gouts of fresh blood which trickled from the corners of the mouth and ran over the chin and neck. Even the deep, burning eyes seemed set amongst swollen flesh, for the lids and pouches underneath were bloated. It seemed as if the whole awful creature were simply gorged with blood. He lay like a filthy leech, exhausted with his repletion. I shuddered as I bent over to touch him, and every sense in me revolted at the contact, but I had to search, or I was lost. The coming night might see my own body a banquet in a similar way of those horrid three. I felt all over the body, but no sign could I find of the key. Then I stopped and looked at the Count. There was a mocking smile on the bloated face which seemed to drive me mad. This was the being I was helping to transfer to London, where, perhaps, for centuries to come he might, amongst its teeming millions, satiate his lust for blood, and create a new and ever-widening circle of semi-demons to batten on the helpless. The very thought drove me mad. A terrible desire came upon me to rid that world of such a monster. There was no lethal weapon at hand, but I seized a shovel, which the workmen had been using to fill the cases, and lifting it, struck high with the edge downward at the hateful face. But as I did so, the head turned, and the eyes fell full upon me with all their blaze of basilisk horror. The sight seemed to paralyze me, and the shovel turned in my hand and glanced from the face, merely making a deep gash above the forehead. The shovel fell from my hand across the box, and as I pulled it away, the flange of the blade caught the edge of the lid, which fell over again and hid the horrid thing from my sight. The last glimpse I had was of the bloated face, blood-stained and fixed with a grin of malice which would have held its own against the nethermost hell. I thought and thought what should be my next move, but my brain seemed on fire, and I waited with a despairing feeling growing over me. As I waited, I heard in the distance a gypsy song sung by merry voices coming closer, and through their song the rolling of heavy wheels and the cracking of whips, the Zagani and the Slovaks of whom the Count had spoken, were coming. With the last look around and the box which contained the vile body, I ran from the place and gained the Count's room, determined to rush out the moment the door should be opened. With strained ears I listened, and heard downstairs the grinding of the key in the great lock and the falling back of the heavy door. There must have been some other means of entry, or someone had a key for one of the locked doors. And then there came the sound of many feet tramping and dying away in some passage which sent up a clanging echo. I turned to run down again towards the vault where I might find the new entrance, but at the moment there seemed to be a violent puff of wind, and the door to the winding stair blew to with the shock that sent the dust from the lintels flying. When I ran to push it open, I found that it was hopelessly fast. I was again a prisoner, and the net of doom was closing around me more closely. As I write, there is a passage below, a sound of many tramping feet, and the crash of weights being sent down heavily, doubtless the boxes with their freight of earth. There is a sound of hammering. It is the box being nailed down. Now I can hear the heavy feet tramping again in the hall, and many other idle feet coming behind them. The door is shut, and the chains rattle. There is the grinding of the key in the lock. I can hear the key withdrawn. Then another door opens and shut. I can hear the creaking of lock and bolt. Hark! In the courtyard and down the rocky way, the roll of heavy wheels, the crack of whips, the chorus of the Zagani as they pass into the distance. I am alone in the castle with those awful women. Foe! Mina is a woman. There is naught in common. They are devils of the pit. I shall not remain alone with them. I shall try to scale the castle wall further than I have yet attempted. I shall take some of the gold with me, lest I want it later. I may find a way from this dreadful place, and then a way for home, a way to the quickest and nearest train, away from this cursed spot, from this cursed land where the devil and his children still walk with earthly feet. At least God's mercy is better than that of these monsters, and the precipice is steep and high. At its foot, a man may sleep as a man. Goodbye, all. Mina. Chapter 5. Letter from Miss Mina Murray to Miss Lucy Westenra, 9th of May. My dearest Lucy, forgive me my long delay in writing, but I have been simply overwhelmed with work. The life of an assistant schoolmistress is sometimes trying. I am longing to be with you, and by the sea, where we can talk freely together and build our castles in the air. I have been working very hard lately because I want to keep up with Jonathan's studies, and I have been practicing shorthand very assiduously. When we are married, I shall be able to be useful to Jonathan, and if I can stenograph well enough, I can take down what he wants to say in this way and write it out for him on the typewriter, at which I am also practicing very hard. He and I sometimes write letters in shorthand, and he is keeping a stenographic journal for his travels abroad. When I'm with you, I shall keep a diary in the same way. I don't mean one of those 2 pages of the week with Sunday squeezed in a corner diaries, but a sort of journal which I can write in whenever I feel inclined. I do not suppose there will be much of an interest to other people, but it is not intended for them. I may show it to Jonathan some day if there is anything worth sharing, but it really is an exercise book. I shall try to do what I see lady journalists do, interviewing and writing descriptions and trying to remember conversations. I am told that with a little practice, one can remember all that goes on, or one that one hears or says during a day. However, we shall see. I shall tell you all my little plans when we meet. I have had just a few hurried lines from Jonathan from Transylvania. He is well and will be returning in about a week. I'm longing to hear all his news. It must be so nice to see strange countries. I wonder if we... I mean, Jonathan and I, shall ever see them together. Oh, there is the 10 o'clock bell ringing. Goodbye, your loving Mina. Tell me all the news when you write. You've not told me anything for a long time. I hear rumors, and especially of a tall, handsome, curly-haired man. Letter. Lucy Westenraw to Mina Murray. 17th Wednesday, Chatham Street. My dearest Mina, I must say you tax me very unfairly with being a bad correspondent. I wrote to you twice since we parted, and your last letter was only your second. Besides, I have nothing to tell you. There really is nothing to interest you. Town is very pleasant right now, and we had a good deal to picture galleries and for walks and rides in the park. As to the tall, curly-haired man, I suppose it was the one who was with me at the last pop. Someone has evidently been telling tales. That was Mr. Holmwood. He often comes to see us, and he and Mama get on very well together. They have so many things to talk about in common. We met some time ago a man that would just do for you if you were not already engaged to Jonathan. He is an excellent parti, being handsome, well off, and of good birth. He's a doctor, and really clever. Just fancy. And he's only 29, and he has an immense lunatic asylum all under his own care. Mr. Holmwood introduced him to me, and he called here to see us, and often comes now. I think he's one of the most resolute men I ever saw, and yet the most calm. He seems absolutely imperturbable. I can fancy what a wonderful power he must have over his patients. He has a curious habit of looking one straight in the face, as if trying to read one's thoughts. He tries this on very much with me, but I flatter myself that he's got a tough nut to crack. I know that from my glass. Did you ever try to read your own face? I do, and I can tell you it is not a bad study. It gives you more trouble than you can well fancy if you've never tried it. He says that I afford him a curious psychological study, and I humbly think I do. I do not, as you know, take sufficient interest in dress to be able to describe the new fashions. Dress is a bore. That is slang again, but never mind. Arthur says that every day. There, it is all out. Mina, we have told all of our secrets together since we were children. We slept together and have eaten together, have laughed and cried together, and now, though I have spoken, I would like to speak more. Oh, Mina, couldn't you guess? I love him. I'm blushing as I write, for although I think he loves me, he has not told me so in words. But, oh, Mina, I love him. I love him. I love him. There, that does me good. I wish I were with you, dear, sitting by the fire undressing as we used to sit, and I would try to tell you what I feel. I do not know how I'm writing this even to you. I'm afraid to stop or I should tear up the letter, and I don't want to stop, and I do so want to tell you all about it. Let me hear from you at once and tell me all you think about it. Mina, I must stop. Good night. Bless me in your prayers, and Mina, pray for my happiness. Lucy. P.S. I need not tell you this is a secret. Good night again. L. Letter. Lucy Westenra to Mina Murray. 24th of May. My dearest Mina, thanks and thanks and thanks again for your sweet letter. It was so nice to be able to tell you and to have your sympathy. My dear, it never rains but it pours. How true the old proverbs are. Here am I, who shall be 20 in September, and yet I have never had a proposal till today, not a real proposal, and today I've had 3. Just fancy, 3 proposals in one day? Isn't it awful? I feel sorry, really and truly sorry, for 2 of the poor fellows. Oh, Mina, I'm so happy I don't know what to do with myself, and 3 proposals! Oh, but for goodness sake, don't tell any of the girls, or they'd be getting all sorts of extravagant ideas and imagining themselves injured and slighted at their very first day at home that they did not get 6 at least. Some girls are so vain. You and I, Mina dear, who are engaged, are not going to settle down so soon soberly into old married women, can despise vanity. Well, I must tell you about the 3, but you must keep it a secret, dear, from everyone. Except, of course, Jonathan. You will tell him, because I would, if I were in your place. Certainly tell Arthur. A woman ought to tell her husband everything, don't you think, dear? And I must be fair. Men like women, certainly their wives, to be quite as fair as they are, and women, I'm afraid, are not always quite as fair as they should be. Well, my dear, number one came just before lunch. I told you of him. Dr. John Seward, the lunatic asylum man, with the strong jaw and the good forehead. He was very cool outwardly, but was nervous all the same. He had been evidently schooling himself in all sorts of little things, and remembered them, but he had almost managed to sit down on his silk hat, which men don't generally do when they are cool, and then when he wanted to appear at ease, he kept playing with a lancet in the way that almost made me scream. He spoke to me, Mina, very straightforwardly. He told me how dear I was to him, though he had known me so little, and what his life would be with me to help and cheer him. He was going to tell me how unhappy he would be if I did not care for him, but when he saw me cry, he said he was a brute and would not add to my present trouble. And then he broke off and asked if I could love him in time, and when I shook my head, his hands trembled. And then, with some hesitation, he asked me if I cared already for anyone else. He put it very nicely, saying he did not want to wring my confidence from me, but only to know, because if a woman's heart was free, a man might have hope. And then, Mina, I felt it sort of a duty to tell him there was someone. I only told him that much. And then he stood up and looked very strong and very grave as he took both of my hands in his and said he hoped I would be happy, and that if I ever wanted a friend, I must count him one of my best. Oh, Mina, dear, I can't help crying, and you must excuse this letter being all blotted. Being proposed to is all very nice and all that sort of thing, but it isn't at all a happy thing when you have to see a poor fellow whom you know loves you honestly going away and looking all broken-hearted, and to know that no matter what he might say at the moment, you are passing quite out of his life. My dear, I must stop here at present. I feel so miserable, though I am so happy. Evening. Arthur has just gone, and I feel in better spirits than when I left off, so I can go on telling you about the day. Well, my dear, number two came in after lunch. He's such a nice fellow, an American from Texas. He looks so young and so fresh that it seems almost impossible that he has been so many places and has had such adventures. I sympathize with poor Desdemona when she had such a dangerous stream poured in her ear, even by a black man. I suppose that we women are such cowards that we think a man will save us from fears, and we marry him. I know now what I would do if I were a man and wanted to make a girl love me. No, I don't, for there was Mr. Morris telling us his stories, and Arthur never told any, and yet, my dear, I am somewhat previous. Mr. Quincy P. Morris found me alone. It seems like a man always does find a girl alone. No, he doesn't, for Arthur tried twice to make a chance, and I helping him all I could. I'm not ashamed to say it now. I must tell you beforehand that Mr. Morris doesn't always speak slang. That is to say, he never does so to strangers or before them, for he is really well educated and has exquisite manners. But he found out that it amused me to hear him talk American slang, and whenever I was present and there was no one to be shocked, he said such funny things. I'm afraid, my dear, he has to invent it all, for it fits exactly into whatever else he has to say. But this is a way slang has. I do not know myself if I shall ever speak slang. I do not know if Arthur likes it, and I've never heard him use any as of yet. Well, Mr. Morris sat down beside me and looked as happy and jolly as he could, but I could see all the same he was very nervous. He took my hand in his and said ever so sweetly, "Miss Lucy, I know I ain't good enough to regulate the fixings of your little shoes, but I guess if you wait till you find a man, that is, you will go join them alongside seven young women with the lamps when you quit. Won't you just hitch up alongside of me and let us go down the long road together, driving in double harness?" Well, he did look so good-humored and so jolly that it didn't seem half so hard to refuse him as it did poor Dr. Seward. So I said, as lightly as I could, that I did not know anything of hitching, and that I wasn't broken to harness at all yet. Then he said he had spoken in a light manner, and he hoped that if he had made a mistake in doing so, on so grave, so momentous an occasion for him, I would forgive him. He really did look serious when he was saying it, and I couldn't help feeling a bit serious, too. I know, Mina, you will think of me a horrid flirt, though I couldn't help feeling a sort of exultation that he was number two in one day. And then, my dear, before I could say a word, he began pouring out a perfect torrent of lovemaking, laying his very heart and soul at my feet. He looked so earnest over it that I shall never again think that a man must be playful always and never earnest because he is merry at times. I suppose he saw something in my face that checked him, for he suddenly stopped and said with a sort of manly fervor that I could have loved him for if I had been free, "Lucy, you are an honest-hearted girl, I know. I should not be here speaking to you as I am now if I did not believe you clean grit right through the very depths of your soul. Tell me, like one good fellow to another, is there anyone else that you care for? And if there is, I'll never trouble you a hair's breadth again, but will be, if you let me, a very faithful friend." "My dear Mina, why are men so noble when we women are so little worthy of them? Here was I, almost making fun of this great-hearted, true gentleman." I burst into tears. "I am afraid, my dear, you will think this a very sloppy letter in more ways than one, and I really felt very badly. Why can't they let a girl marry three men, or as many as may want her, and save all this trouble? Oh, but this is a heresy, I must not say it. I am glad to say that, though I was crying, I was able to look into Mr. Morris's brave eyes, and I told him straight, 'Yes, there is someone I love, though he has not told me yet that he even loves me.' I was right to speak to him so frankly, for quite a light came into his face, and he put out both of his hands and took mine. I think I put them into his, and he said in a hearty way, 'That's my brave girl. It's better worth being late for a chance of winning you than being in time for any other girl in the world. Don't cry, my dear. If it's for me, I'm a hard nut to crack, and I take it standing up. If that other fellow doesn't know his happiness, well, he'd better look for it soon, or he'll have to deal with me. Little girl, your honesty and pluck have made me a friend, and that's rarer than a lover. It's more unselfish, anyhow. My dear, I'm going to have a pretty lonely walk between this and Kingdom Come. Won't you give me one kiss? It can be something to keep off the darkness now and then. You can, you know, if you like, for that other fellow. He must be a good fellow, my dear, and a fine fellow, or you could not love him. Hasn't spoken yet.'" That quite won me, Mina, for it was brave and sweet of him, and noble, too, to a rival, wasn't it? And he was so sad. So I leant over and kissed him. He stood up with my two hands in his, and he looked down into my face. I'm afraid I was blushing very much. And he said, "Little girl, I hold your hand, and you've kissed me. And if these things don't make us friends, then nothing ever will. Thank you for your sweet honesty to me, and goodbye." He wrung my hand, and taking up his hat, went straight out of the room without looking back, without a tear or a quiver or a pause, and I'm crying like a baby. Oh, why must a man like that be made unhappy when there are lots of girls about who would worship the very ground he trod on? I knew I would if I were free. Only, I don't want to be free. My dear, this quite upset me, and I feel like I cannot write of happiness just at once after telling you of it. And I don't wish to tell of the number three till it can be all happy. Ever your loving, Lucy. P.S. Oh, about number three. I needn't tell you of number three, need I? Besides, it was all so confused. It seemed only a moment from his coming into the room till both of his arms were around me and he was kissing me. I am very, very happy, and I don't know what shall I have done to deserve it. I must only try in the future to show I am not ungrateful for all his goodness to me in sending me such a lover, such a husband, and such a friend. Goodbye. Dr. Seward's Diary, kept in phonograph. 25th of April. Ebb tide in appetite today. Cannot eat, cannot rest, so diary instead. Since my rebuff of yesterday, I have a sort of empty feeling. Nothing in the world seems of sufficient importance to be worth the doing. As I know that the only cure for this sort of thing was work, I went down amongst the patients. I picked out one who has afforded me a study of much interest. He is so quaint in his ideas and so unlike the normal lunatic that I've determined to understand him as well as I can. Today I seem to get nearer than ever before to the heart of his mystery. I questioned him more fully than I have ever done, with a view to making myself master of the facts of his hallucination. In my manner of doing it there was, I now see, something of cruelty. I seemed to wish to keep him to the point of his madness, a thing which I avoid with the patience as I would the mouth of hell. Mamori, under what circumstances should I not avoid the pit of hell? Omnia Romae Venalia sunt. Hell has its price. Verbum sapiente. If there anything be behind this instinct, it will be valuable to trace it afterwards accurately, so I'd better commence to do so. Therefore, R. M. Renfield. About 59. Sanguine temperament. Great physical strength. Morbidly excitable. Periods of gloom ending in some fixed idea which I cannot make out. I presume that the sanguine temperament itself and the disturbing influence end in a mentally accomplished finish. A possibly dangerous man. Probably dangerous, if unselfish. In selfish men, caution is as secure an armor for their foes as for themselves. What I think of on this point is, when self is the fixed point, the centripetal force is balanced with the centrifugal. When duty, a cause, etc. is the fixed point, the latter force is paramount, and only accidents, or a series of accidents, can balance it. Letter. Quincy P. Morris to the Honorable Arthur Holmwood. 25th of May. My dear Art, we've told yarns by the campfire in the prairies, and dressed one another's wounds while trying a landing at the Marquesas, and drunk hearths on the shore of Titicaca. There's more yarns to be told, and other wounds to be healed, and another health to be drunk. Won't you let this be at my campfire tomorrow night? I have no hesitation in asking you, as I know a certain lady is engaged on a certain dinner party, and that you're free. There will only be one other, our old pal at the Korea, Jack Seward. He's coming too, and we both want to mingle our weeps over the wine cup and drink a health to all of our hearts and the happiest man in the whole wide world, who's won the noblest heart that God has made and the best worth winning. We promise you a hearty welcome, a loving greeting, and the health as true as your own right hand. We shall both swear to leave you at home if you drink too deep to a certain pair of eyes. Come. Yours, as ever and always, Quincy P. Morris. Telegram from Arthur Holmwood to Quincy P. Morris, 26th of May. Count me in every time. I bear messages which will make both of your ears tingle. Art. Chapter 6. Mina Murray's Journal. 24th of July, Whitby. Lucy met me at the station, looking sweeter and lovelier than ever, and we drove up to the house at the Crescent in which they have rooms. This is a lovely place. The little river, the Esk, runs through a deep valley, which broadens out as it comes near the harbor. A great viaduct runs across, with high piers, through which the view seems somehow further away than it really is. The valley is beautifully green, and is so steep that when you're on the high land at either side, you look right across it, unless you're near enough to see down. The houses of the old town, the side away from us, are all red-roofed, and seem piled up over one another anyhow, like the pictures we see of Nuremberg. Right over the town is the ruin of Whitby Abbey, which was sacked by the Danes, and which is the scene of part of Marmion, where the girl was built into the wall. It is a most noble ruin, of immense size, and full of beautiful and romantic bits. There is a legend about a white lady, as seen in one of the windows. Between it and the town there is another church, the parish one, round which is a big graveyard, all full of tombstones. This is, to my mind, the nicest spot in Whitby, for it lies right over the town, and has a full view of the harbor and all the way up the bay where the headland called Kettleness stretches out into the sea. It descends so steeply over the harbor that part of the bank has fallen away and some of the graves have been destroyed. In one place, part of the stonework of the graves stretches out over the sandy pathway far below. There are walks, with seats beside them, through the graveyard, and people go and sit there all day long, looking at the beautiful view and enjoying the breeze. I shall come and sit here very often to myself and work. Indeed, I'm writing now, with my book on my knee, and listening to the talk of three old men who are sitting beside me. They seem to do nothing all day except sit up here and talk. The harbor lies below me, with, on the other side, one long granite wall stretching out into the sea, and a curve outwards at the end of it, in the middle of which is a lighthouse. A heavy seawall runs alongside of it. On the near side, the seawall makes an elbow crooked inversely, and its end, too, has a lighthouse. Between the two piers there is a narrow opening into the harbor, which then suddenly widens. It is nice at high tide, but when the tide is out, it shoals away to nothing, and there's merely the stream of the Esk, running between banks of sands, with rocks here and there. Outside the harbor on this side, there rises, for about a half a mile, a great reef, the sharp edge of which runs straight out from behind the south lighthouse. At the end of it is a buoy, with a bell, which swings in bad weather, and sends a mournful sound on the wind. They have a legend here that when a ship is lost, bells are heard out at sea. I must ask the old man about this. He's coming this way. He's a funny old man. He must be awfully cold, for his face is all gnarled and twisted like the bark of a tree. He tells me he's nearly 100, and that he was a sailor in the Greenland fishing fleet when Waterloo was fought. He is, I am afraid, a very skeptical person, for when I asked him about the bells at sea and the white lady at the abbey, he said very brusquely, "I wouldn't fash myself about them, miss. Them things be all wore out. Mind, I don't say they never was, but I do say they wasn't in my time. They be all very well for comers and trippers and the like, but not for a nice lady like you. Them fleetfoots from York and Leeds that be always eating cured herrings and drinking tea and looking out to buy cheap jet would creed aught. I wonder myself who be bothered telling lies to him, even the newspapers, which is full of fool talk." I thought he would be a good person to learn interesting things from, so I asked him if he would mind telling me about the whale fishing in the old days. He was just settling himself to begin when the clock struck six, whereupon he labored to get up and said, "I must gang again words now, miss. My granddaughter doesn't like to be kept waiting when the tea is ready, for it takes me time to cramble about the grease, for there be many of them. And, miss, I lack belly timber sairly by the clock." He hobbled away, and I could see him hurrying as well as he could down the steps. The steps are a great feature of the place. They lead from the town up to the church. There are hundreds of them, I do not know how many, and they wind up in a delicate curve. The slope is so gentle that a horse could easily walk up and down them. I think they must have had something to do with the abbey originally. I shall go home, too. Lucy went out visiting with her mother, and they were only duty calls. I did not go. They will be home by this. 1st of August. I came up here an hour ago with Lucy, and we had a most interesting talk with my old friend and the two others who always come and join him. He's evidently the Sir Oracle of them, and I should think must have been in his time a most dictatorial person. He will not admit anything, and downfaces everybody. If he can't out-argue with them, he bullies them, and then takes their silence for agreement with his views. Lucy was looking sweetly pretty in her white long frock. She has got a beautiful color since she's been here. I noticed that the old men did not lose any time coming up and sitting near her when we sat down. She's so sweet with old people. I think they all fell in love with her on the spot. Even my old man succumbed and did not contradict her, but gave me double share instead. I got him on the subject of the legends, and he went off at once into some sort of sermon. I must try to remember it and put it down. "It be all fool talk, lock, stock, and barrel. That's what it be, and naught else. These bands and wafts and bogos and bar guests and boggles and all an end to the only fit to set bairns and dizzy women a-belderin'. They be naught but air-blibs. They, and all grims and signs and warnings, be all invented by parsons as ills and book bodies and railway touters to skeer and scunner halflings, and to get folks to do something that they don't other incline to. It makes me ireful to think of them. Why, it's them that, not content with printing lies on paper and preaching them out of pulpits, does want to be cutting them on the tombstones. Look all here around you, in what airt they will. All them stones, holding up their heads as well as they can, lent out of their pride as it can't, simply tumbling down with the weight of the lies wrote on them. Here lies the body, or sacred to the memory, wrote on all of them. And yet nigh half of them, they ain't beat no bodies at all. And the memories of them hadn't been cared a pinch of snuff about, much less sacred. Lies, all of them. Nothing but lies of one kind or another. My Gog, and it'll be a quare scunderment of the Day of Judgment when they come tumbling up in here in their death sarks, all juped together and trying to drag their tombstones with them to prove how good they was, some of them trimlin' and dithering with their hands that dozied up and slipping in line into the sea they can't even keep their grip on them. I could see the old fellow's self-satisfied air, and the way in which he looked round for the approval of his cronies that he was showing off, so I put in a word to keep him going. "Oh, Mr. Swales, you can't be serious. Surely these tombstones are not all wrong." "Yeah, Blends. There may be a purish few not wrong, savin' where they make out the people too good. For there be folk that do think a balm bowl be like the sea, if only it be their own. The whole thing be only lies. Now look you here. You come here a stranger, and you see this Kirkgarth." I nodded, for I thought it was better to assent, though I did not quite understand his dialect. I knew it had something to do with the church. He went on, "And you can say it with all these stones be a bone fluke that happened here, snod and snog." I assented again. "Then that be just where the lie comes in. Why, there be scores of these laybeds that be tomb as old Dun's back-a-box on Friday night." He nudged one of his companions, and they all laughed. "Aye, my Gog, how could they be otherwise? Look at that one, the aftest abaft the beer bank, read it." I went over and I read. "Edward Spenslaw, Master Mariner, murdered by pirates off the coast of Andres, April 1854, at 30. When I came back, Mr. Swales went on. "Who brought him home, I wonder, to hap him here? Murdered off the coast of Andres, and ye consated his body lay under. Why, I can name ye a dozen of the bones lying Greenland seas above," he pointed northwards, "or where the currents may have drifted em. There be stones around ye, where you can with your young eyes read the small print of the lies from here. This Braithwaite Lowry, I knew his father, lost in the Lively off Greenland in 20. Or Andrew Woodhouse, drowned in the same seas in 1777, or John Paxton, drowned off Cape Farewell a year later. Or old John Rawlings, whose grandfather sailed with me, drowned in the Gulf of Finland in 50. Do you think all these men will have made a rush to Whitby when the trumpet sounds? I have me aythrums about it. I tell ye, when they got here, they'd be jomblin' and jostlin' one another the way it'd be like a fight up the ice in the old days, when we'd be at one another from daylight to dark, and trying to tie up our cuts by the light of the aurora borealis." This was evidently local pleasantry, for the old men cackled over it, and his cronies joined in with gusto. "But surely," I said, "you're not quite correct, for you start on the assumption that all the poor people, or their spirits, will have to take their tombstones with them on the Day of Judgment. Do you think that will really be necessary?" "Well, what else be they tombstones for? Answer me that, miss." "To please their relatives, I suppose." "To please their relatives, you suppose," he said with an intense scorn. "How will it pleasure their relatives to know that lies were wrote over em, and that everybody in the place knows that they be lies?" He pointed to a stone at our feet, which had been laid down as a slab, on which the seat was rested close to the edge of the cliff. "Read the lines on that thruff stone," he said. The letters were upside down for me from where I sat, but Lucy was more opposite to them, so she leant over and read. "Sacred to the memory of George Cannon, who died in the hope of a glorious resurrection on July 29th, 1873, falling from the rocks at Kettleness. This tomb is erected by a sorrowing mother to her dearly beloved son." He was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. "Really, Mr. Swales, I don't see anything funny in that." She spoke her comment very gravely and somewhat severely. "You don't see aught funny? Ha ha. But that's because you don't garm. The sorrowin' mother was a hellcat that hated him because he was a crooked. A regular lamater he was, and he hated her so that he committed suicide, that she mightn't get an insurance she put on his life. He blew nigh the top of his head off with an old musket they'd been for scaring crows with. 'Twarn't for crows then, for 'twat the Craigs and drops on him. That's the way he fell off the rocks. And as to the hopes of a glorious resurrection, I've often heard him say myself he hoped he'd go to hell, for his mother was so pious that she'd be sure to go to heaven, and he didn't want to addle where she was. Now, isn't that stone at any rate? He hammered at it with his stick as he spoke. A pack of lies. Won't it make Gabriel keckle when Geordie comes panting up the greens with the tombstone balanced on his hump and asks it to be took as evidence? I did not know what to say, but Lucy turned the conversation as she said, rising up, "Oh, why did you tell us of this? This is my favorite seat, and I cannot leave it. And now I find I must go on sitting over the grave of a suicide." "Oh, that won't harm you, me pretty. It may make poor Georgie glad to have so trim a lass sitting on his lap. That won't hurt ye. Why, I've sat on and off nigh 20 years past, and it hasn't done me no harm. Don't you fash about these lies under ye, and it doesn't lie there either. It'll be time for ye to be getting scart when you see the tombstones all run away with, and the place as bare as a stubble field. There's the clock. I must be going. My service to ye, ladies." And off he hobbled. Lucy and I sat for a while, and it was all so beautiful before that we took hands as we sat. And she told me all over again about Arthur and their coming marriage. That made me just a little heartsick, for I hadn't heard of Jonathan for a whole month. The same day. I came up here alone, for I'm very sad. There was no letter for me. I hope there cannot be anything the matter with Jonathan. The clock has just struck 9. I see all the lights scattered over town, sometimes in rows where the streets are, and sometimes singly. They run right up the Esk and die away in the curve of the valley. To my left, the view is cut off by a black line of roof in the old house next to the abbey. The sheep and lambs are bleating in the field away behind me, and there is a clatter of donkey hoofs on the paved road below. The band on the pier is playing a harsh waltz in good time, and further along the quay there is a Salvation Army meeting in a back street. Neither of the bands hears the other, but up here I hear and see them both. I wonder where Jonathan is, and if he's thinking of me. I wish he were here. Dr. Seward's Diary. 5th of June. The case of Renfield grows more interesting the more I get to understand the man. He has certain qualities very largely developed. Selfishness, secrecy, and purpose. I wish I could get at what is the object of the latter. He seems to have some settled scheme of his own, but what it is I do not yet know. His redeeming quality is a love of animals, though, indeed, he has such curious turns in it that I sometimes imagine he is only abnormally cruel. His pets are of odd sorts. Just now, his hobby is catching flies. He has at present such a quantity that I had myself to expostulate. To my announcement, he did not break out into a fury, as I expected, but took the matter in simple seriousness. He thought for a moment, then said, "May I have 3 days? I shall clear them away." Of course, I said that would do. I must watch him. 18th of June. He has turned his mind now to spiders, and has got several very big fellows in a box. He keeps feeding them with his flies, and the number of the latter is becoming sensibly diminished, though he's used half of his food in attracting more flies from outside his room. 1st of July. His spiders are now becoming as great a nuisance as his flies, so I told him today that he must get rid of them. He looked very sad at this, so I said he must clear out some of them, at all events. He cheerfully acquiesced to this, and I gave him the same time as before for reduction. He disgusted me much while with him, for when a horrid blowfly, bloated with some carrion food, buzzed into the room, he caught it, held it exultingly for a few moments before his finger and thumb, and before I knew what he was going to do, put it in his mouth and ate it. I scolded him for it, but he argued quietly that it was very good and very wholesome, that it was life, strong life, and gave life to him. This gave me an idea, or a rudiment of one. I must watch how he gets rid of his spiders. He has evidently some deep problems in his mind, for he keeps a little notebook in which he is always jotting down something. Whole pages of it are filled with masses of figures, generally single numbers added up in batches, and then some totals added in batches again, although he was focusing some account, as the auditors put it. 8th of July. There is a method in his madness, and the rudimentary idea in my mind is growing. It'll be a whole idea soon, and then, oh, unconscious cerebration, you will have to give the wall to your conscious brother. I kept away from my friend for a few days, so that I might notice if there were any change. Things remain as they were, except he parted with some of his pets and got a new one. He managed to get a sparrow, and has already partially tamed it. His means of taming is simple, for already the spiders have diminished. Those that do remain, however, are well fed, for he still brings the flies by tempting them with his food. 19th of July. We are progressing. My friend now has a whole colony of sparrows, and his flies and spiders are almost obliterated. When I came in, he ran to me and said he wanted to ask me a favor, a very, very great favor, and as he spoke, he fawned on me like a dog. I asked him what it was, and he said, with a sort of rapture in his voice and bearing, "A kitten! A nice little, sleek, playful kitten that I can play with and teach and feed and feed and feed." I was not unprepared for this request, for I had noticed how his pets went on increasing in size and vivacity, but I did not care that his pretty family of tame sparrows should be wiped out in the same manner as the flies and the spiders, so I said I would see about it, and asked him if he would not rather have a cat than a kitten. His eagerness betrayed him as he answered, "Oh yes, I would like a cat. I only asked for a kitten lest you should refuse me a cat. No one would refuse me a kitten, would they?" I shook my head, and said at present I feared it would not be possible, but I would see about it. His face fell, and I could see a warning of danger in it, for there was a sudden, fierce, sidelong look, which meant killing. The man is an undeveloped homicidal maniac. I shall test him with his present craving, and see how it will work out. Then I shall know more. 10 p.m. I have visited him again, and found him sitting in a corner, brooding. When I came in, he threw himself on his knees before me, and implored me to let him have a cat, that his salvation depended upon it. I was firm, however, and told him he could not have it, whereupon he went without a word and sat down, gnawing his fingers in the corner where I'd found him. I shall see him in the morning early. 20th of July. Visited Renfield very early, before the attendant went his rounds. Found him up and humming a tune. He was spreading out his sugar, which he had saved in the window, and was manifestly beginning his fly-catching again, and beginning it cheerfully and with good grace. I looked around for his birds, and not seeing them, asked them where they were. He replied, without turning round, that they'd all flown away. There were a few feathers about the room, and on his pillow a drop of blood. I said nothing, but went and told the keeper to report to me if there had been anything odd about him during the day. 11 a.m. The attendant has just been to me to say that Renfield has been very sick, and has disgorged a whole lot of feathers. "My belief is, doctor," he said, "that he has eaten his birds, and that he just took and ate them raw." 11 p.m. I gave Renfield a strong opiate tonight, enough to make even him sleep, and took away his pocketbook to look at it. The thought that has been buzzing about my brain lately is complete, and the theory proved. My homicidal maniac is of a peculiar kind. I shall have to invent a new classification for him, and call him a zoophagus, life-eating maniac. And what he desires to absorb as many lives as he can, and he has laid himself out to achieve it in a cumulative way. He gave many flies to one spider, and many spiders to one bird, and then he wanted a cat to eat the many birds. What would have been his later steps? It would almost be worthwhile to complete the experiment. It might be done if only there was a sufficient cause. Men sneered at vivisection, and let you look at the results today. Why not advance science in its most difficult and vital aspect, the knowledge of the brain? Had even I one secret of such minds? Did I hold the key to the fancy of even one lunatic? I might advance my own branch of science to the pitch with what Burden Sanderson's physiology or Ferrier's brain knowledge would be as nothing. If only there was a sufficient cause. I must not think too much of this, or I may be tempted. A good cause might turn the scale with me, for may I not too be of an exceptional brain congenially? How well the man reasoned. Lunatics always do with their own scope. I wonder at how many lives he values a man, or if at only one. He had closed the account most accurately, and today begun a new record. How many of us begin a new record with each day of our lives? To me it seems only yesterday that my whole life ended with my new hope, and that truly I began a new record. So will it be until the great recorder sums me up and closes my ledger account with a balanced profit or loss. Oh, Lucy. Lucy, I cannot be angry with you, nor can I be angry with my friend whose happiness is yours. But I must only wait on hopeless and work. Work, work. If only could I have as strong a cause as my poor mad friend there, a good, unselfish cause to make me work, that would indeed be happiness. This has been Rachel Reading Bookshelf with part 3 of Dracula by Bram Stoker. Have a wonderful day.